Accession number 17629, David Ridley, reel 12.
Mr. Ridley, reel 12. You were telling me the story of an action that was coming up.
Well, this Jimmy McGarry was always a character in the songs, but he would stand up there and he would tell his stories for hours and hours and hours on end. One of the characters in the battalion. he eventually was sergeant major at Chessy Street at the drill hall down here. We were all in the same company at the time. Anyway, his platoon had gone into this house, and it was on the edge of a canal. And I remember Jimmy telling me, he says, there, and all his platoon's weapons was in the house. And the reason why this is vivid in my memory, Jimmy actually told me, he says, I was standing at a window with his binoculars on, looking up this road. And an SP gun, a German SP, about 50 yards away, just stuck the barrel of the gun round the house it was hiding behind, and bang, and flattened this house that Jimmy was in. How he got out, I have no idea. But he lost all his weapons. So the next thing that happened, there's a load of Bren guns and rifles on. Well, blooming, you know, the presenting the grease that they normally have when they're in storage, came to my platoon and I had to clean all these, well, my men had to clean all these weapons. And I said, well, you know, what's all this in here, though? They said, number two platoon has lost all its weapons and you've got to, you know, clean them up and take them forward. And that's how Jimmy McGarry lost all his weapons. And I had a rum and job of cleaning them. Well, of course, I give them the little bit of me tongue for that. Another, well, not funny, like, but another thing that happened in there. See, Jimmy was always this character, you know, it was always a big laugh. Well, Jimmy lost quite a few men with snipers. So during the day, he says, I'm going to get this sod. And he crawled along this embankment, silently, quietly, you know, sort of take his chapel by surprise. But unfortunately, he crawled under a great big bush that was filled with guinea fowl. And soon as ever he went into the bush, all the guinea fowl went flapping and squawking away so that broke his cover. That was another funny thing there. How he got across that canal was they brought a tank up with, it was a specially made tank. It had tracks on the top instead of a turret. And they just drove it into the canal. And then it opened these tracks and the turret, where the turret normally is. And then other tanks used to come up and just drove across. That was one way of getting across there. That's about all I can remember. Just one more thing there was a poor little donkey standing there. More holes in it than enough. Had been left out. And horses, there was horses running about all over the place. We tried to catch them, but they were so, you know, frightened at their job.
Did you use mules in the mountainous areas?
Did I what?
Use mules in the mountainous areas, the hilly areas. Did you use mules for bringing...
Oh, mules! Yes. We were pulled back one time, and I don't know just where it was, and we did mountain training. And this is where we introduced those tea packs, or whatever they call them. Certainly what the Chinese use. We introduced to them. They've got a special name, I can't remember it. And they used to put a box of ammunition, 303, on. And believe me, it's a weird. And they were taught you, don't walk on your toes climbing up the mountain. You had to walk flat-footed. Otherwise, you should pull all and strain all your muscles. That's one part I can remember about that. And then we were taught how to load mules. How to, you know, how to t- tie boxes of ammunition and petrol or whatever we had to use and hook it onto these mules. And then in the case of you, get a mule who would spend blooming hours loading it up, and then it would take the gear and start to kick. You kick a whole lot off. You had to start off again. Mules did a very good job in the mountains. Well, that's the only way you could get any equipment forward. And I always remember, at this particular time, it was even in the summer, we're sitting on this mountainside, the sun beating down, you know, beautiful day. And I look down in the valley, and I could see these figures moving. And then, maybe it was an hour and a half after, up would come the colour sergeant, Tudor Davis. So he had no head, Tudor, you know, he had off and he bald the head, was steaming like anything, cursing like anything at these blooming mules. But that's the only way we could get food in that up.
Do you recall the division moving over to the east to help in one of Montgomery's attacks?
Yes, the time I was talking about the wet weather and this nissen hunting not in the mountains, this was the beginning of breaking into the Po Valley, and we were ordered to attack and attack and attack. And eventually, when the attack finally went through, we were pulled out of the mountains and pushed in behind the main troops. I didn't see very much of that because I was withdrawn out of the mountains and sent on a wee sleeve with my friend. I always used to go on leave with him. It was my turn to go on leave. And I was praying that Lee wouldn't be stopped because I knew there was an attack coming off. But anyway, Tudor and I went to Rome. And when the main attack, when they broke into the Po Valley, I was in Rome, actually. And I never saw no more action in Italy after that because we were in transit camps. And we go to the police in the transit camp and say, "Can you tell me where the 8th Army is?" Where is the 1st Battalion Durham Light Infantry? He said, "Mate," he says, "I can't even tell you where the Army is, never mind what the 1st Battalion." But we used to see the bombers going across. In actual fact, I saw this when they first bombed the monastery casino. I saw that. And they were right on the nose. I never actually went up to, never got up to see actually what the damage was. If I ever go back to Italy, I'll definitely go and see it. Anyway, we were lying in his transit camp having a good time, you know, nothing to do. And he's my friend roaming around wanting to get back to the battalion. I said, "Oh, sit still there, never mind about getting back." But anyway, the war was over then. Eventually, he did spot a DLI truck, you know, on transit or somewhere, and we just told the chaps in the transit camp that there was a transport for there, and we were going back to the battalion. And we got back to the battalion.
Where were they then?
Oh, I couldn't tell where. It was a big town just on the entrance of the Po Valley. We weren't in a town, actually. We were all billeted again in houses. And
this was at an arrest situation?
Yes, uh-huh.
Do you recall being in the silent night attack on the Pagola Ridge? Did you take part in that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where to go over the top of the mountain. What do you remember
of
that?
I'll tell you a peculiar thing of that. Well, it was silent up to a certain extent. And afterwards, we had to put a barrage down for us. And we had these creeping barrages, they deadly things to follow up. Because the shrapnel flying around all over the blooming place. But I always remember this. We had three platoons in line going forward. And one of the platoons drifted in front of another platoon. You know, instead of keeping on a direct axis, it sort of veered off to the left and it walked in front of another platoon. And a brand gun had gone down, and he thought it was enemy. And we had 28 rounds in a brand magazine. And this brand going to go down, and he fired a full magazine. And you'll not believe this, he hit 20 men out of 28 rounds. And you try and do that on a range, and you can't do it. How? That was just a matter of ill luck, or lucky for the brand gunner. Fortunately, he didn't kill anyone. He just wounded them. When we finally got on the top of this ridge, there was a farmhouse that I went to, and a lot of these farmhouses had cellars, you know, and you had to make sure there was nowhere in, or you're playing with fire or death. And I heard someone in this cellar, and I shouted in my best Italian, you know, come out now on this. And there was a load of screaming going out. Ingalazy, they were wrapping arms around our necks and kissing us and all that. And I was saying, for goodness sake, keep off me. I've got a load of grenades on my belt. You know, I'm fighting in case I pulled one off. Anyway, after the daylight broke, we got calmed down, like, these people were relieved of being the British troops. Finally arrived, and in fact, one of the men, he spoke very, very good English, and he said, "Will you come in here?" And he took us into his house. This is my platoon, actually. He says, "Well, we have waited years for this," and he brought this bottle of wine out and gave us all a toast, and we all, you know, had a toast. We'll always remember that, mate.
And this was the usual case that the Italians received you well, did they?
Oh, yes. Most Italians received as well, because I don't think they were very happy with the Germans at any time. In fact, there's only one girl, when this is after the war, like, we're in a place, I think it was called Gorizia, I'm not sure. And she was, I don't know who would have upset her, but she was trying to speak to me, and I said, "Oh, Italy's as good, and Italy's as this," and all that, sort of boosting the Italian people up and all that. And I said, "Oh, yes, well, I agree with it and all that. Inglesi, no good." And I said, "Well, have you ever been to England?" She says, "No." I said, "Well, you can't talk about it." But that was about the only woman that I ever saw that felt a bit put out. I don't know who had done what to what. I don't know.
Did you ever meet partisans?
Yes. In fact, the time that I got my thumbnail knocked off, I finally went back to look after the battalion equipment, boy, kit bags and officers' cases and whatnot. And they were in a house, a gatehouse, actually, and in this big mansion. This place, I can't tell you the name of the place, it's a pity, but this particular place, it belonged to a cognac manufacturer. And he had a niece and a nephew who could speak very good English. I always remember the chap's name was called George. And I only had two men with us looking after these kid bags and whatnot. And this particular day, this George came for me and he says, "Will you come down in the stables?" He had a stables of about five horses, beautiful horses. You know, these trotters. He had those, and he had the great big sire horses for pulling heavy weights. He had these in the stables. And when I went down, I said, "Well, you know, what's the matter?" And there were six partisans there. And he says, "These have come and are going to take all the horses away from me." And they showed me a document, like, which was all in Italian. I couldn't understand it. I says, "Well, that is George." I says, "Well, I'm sorry." I says, "I've got no authority to stop them." I says, "What I can do with you..." Yeah, I had a truck at me just wrote. I says, "What I can do with you, I'll take you up to this particular town that I was near, And I says, then you can go and see the civil authorities that's authorised this. Which I did do, but they still took the horses from them. I mean, it wouldn't be the civil authorities or the council or whatever who was had ordered these horses to be handed over to the Italian army.
Did you ever see them cutting the hairs of women that had...
No.
behaved with the...
I wasn't very... Well, what's the word? I mean, when you see our regiments drill, and it's something to be proud of. And I don't think I was very, very, what's the word? Not proud, anyway. I've seen the Italians, they were sloppy, really. Mine was... some very good Italian people that I met. I mean, most of them were all right, but I didn't think we were very much of an army.
Is that the only time that you met up with partisans?
Yeah.
In the winter of 44-45, which is basically the period of time we've been talking about, the conditions must have got pretty bad for you.
Oh, they were, yes.
How did you cope with them?
Well, at that particular time, you were sort of living in houses. But you still had to go out into your trenches to do your guards, and if you were attacked, you had to be there. You had to do your patrols in all sorts of prevailing weather. And you just had to cope as best as you can. And in fact, I remember once we went in this house and it was filled with beautiful furniture. We needed a fire to keep ours up, and we chopped all this beautiful furniture up. I suppose the Italian wasn't very happy when they came back to the house and found there was no furniture there. But you just kept yourselves warm as best you could. I can safely say that I was never ever hungry in the army. All food was always there. And most of the time, you know, you lived off the land or you fed yourselves. You used to get tea and sugar and various other things coming up. But I made a remark about the British Army never caters for any means of carrying rations. So therefore, I think half the time the German OP would look out and he would see my platoon coming along. There I was at the front and I carried a sack. A sandbag, you know? And in that sack I had a cocked chicken and a hen. Now this belonged to my brand gunner. These were his pets. And I carried them from one end of Italy to the other. And when we used to get to where we were going, we used to let them out, you know. And then when we had to move into the sack, we went and I carried them. Behind me was Joe with a brand gun. Behind him was somebody carrying a pick and shovel, and behind him the other one was carrying the brew cans, the frying pans, and whatever we had for means of cooking. And I imagine that, I could imagine this, like, a German OP would look and say, what the blooming devil's coming along here? I think I've probably got a good laugh on the show, like, mind, when he went into action, all this was dropped, and then you know, but you sort of bartered as well. I remember once we were going to have a party down in this area where we've been talking about in Fawley and that, because we always used to come back to there for our rest period. And we always used to go to the same houses. And this particular time, we were going to have a party, and I went and I bought a turkey off this woman. I paid £1 for her, 400 lira it was. And believe me, I couldn't lift it. It was like an ostrich. But we didn't do any robbing, I don't think I got, unless there was something just lying there, nobody claimed it. We didn't go in and take anything off the Italians. if you wanted a chicken or anything like that, we used to pay for it. And this particular time, I would tell you were just mentioning about this valley. I forget the name of it, but this is where I first experienced a river being in the air, not in the valley. And I was sent on this patrol. I had to go to this river edge. It was a track I was actually on. And I had to have a stand patrol on this track in case any German troops. And I hunted all over the blooming place for this river. And when it suddenly hit me, I mean, see, the river was dry at a particular time. And it was just the embankments there. And I was saying, wait. And it, after a period of time, it hit me that I was actually on the river. At that time, I happened to say to Joe, I said, I'm sick of carrying this blooming cock in hand. I said, they're going into the blooming pot. No, no, I'll go and get you something. I'll get you something. And he was away at the farmhouse. And this particular time, he came back with a cock chicken, like alive, you know. And I said to one of them, I supposed to have killed it. And he had it on his knee, and he was plucking out the feathers out of it. And I think he pulled the last feather that was in the blooming bird. He pulled the last feather, all right, and a chicken jumped off his head and ran away. I don't think you could ever frighten anybody as much as he did that particular bloke. He got such a blowing shock. I can't remember whether we did actually kill that chicken or not, or whether we let it go or not. But anyway, the cock and hen was never killed. In fact, they were bartered for a bag of sugar off one of the farmers. We never killed them.
The relationships in the platoon must have got really close.
Oh, yes.
Between you all.
You were, after a period of time, well, in my opinion, sergeants and corporals and that, you were all in one. You were more or less mates. You were still respected. You were still addressed as sergeant or corporal or whatever it was like that. But you used to joke among yourselves. You lived in each other's pocket. If they had anybody had any problems, you used to share the problem and was trying to sort it out. You just became one, you know, well, one happy family, really. But I think I told you about this one time I was let down by one private soldier. And I finally took them back, like, but I didn't want them. Not really. I never trusted them anymore after that. Because you've got to have trust. You've got to... when you put someone in a position of defence and allow you the rest of the troops to relax, to go to sleep, if that trust is broken, it's no good at all. You could cost all your lives. In fact, I would like to tell you the story of the subconscious mind. Before the war started, they built a brand new picture house at Chessie Street. And I went there, and the first cinema, or the first film I saw, was a picture called Gunga Din. Now, I don't know if you ever saw that. It starts off with a vulture sitting on a telegraph pole. And it's all about the Indian Army in India, or the British Army in India. And briefly, it was, you had the Tug sect, who used to dig your grave and then come and kill you. That was their religion. And there were stranglers. And this particular patrol was going through these mountains. And these Tugs were dressed up as monks. And they asked this British officer, could we come along with you for protection? Eh? And sure enough, they did. Now, when nightfall came and all bedded down and all that, these Tugs up and were strangling. And you could hear the gurgles and all that, and strangling all these officers. That was briefly of Gunga Din, anyway. And while I was sitting there, I never said to anybody, I said, no, if that ever happened to me, this is what I would do. And we're at a place called Ortona, where I've told you where all these, I was in a Martella Tower. and in this particular time, we'd been attacked, and we didn't have very, very much sleep. Anyway, I always remember I was in his farmhouse and the floor was bricks, you know, laid bricks. And I said to the Sunday, I says, they're waking me at 2 o'clock in the morning. I says, because I must go and visit the Sunday, you see. And in what we used for light was paraffin in an old cigarette tin with a little bit of cloth in, and you used to get a dull glow off them. Well, I must have been so tired, because previously, I always remember when I used to work at the mines, my mother used to come and wake me up, and she never ever got anywhere near me, because I was so, I used to sleep like a pussycat, you know, I used to sense people beside it. But I mean, she must have been so tired that this fella leaned over me and he must have shook me, eh? And I must have awakened straight up. And he was hovering over again to shake me again when I woke up. And all I saw was this dark shape hovering over me. And I opened my feet, bent my feet like that, because I was lying on my back, and I kicked this bloke right into the corner of this building. And then I was fully awake, and I realized what I'd done. And I always said, that's what I thought in that cinema that I would do. And that must have been 3 or 4 years afterwards. The subconscious mind could be clicked over, and that's what I did. And which luckily I did that, because if it had been in the army when I'd thought this, I mean, the obvious thing what I'd done was just pick me Tommy gun up and fire, because it was always lying beside. And I would have killed that bloke. So that's something, a fact, a correct story of the subconscious mind after a period of 4 or 5 years.
Could you sense danger? I see, for example, going on patrol or advancing forward.
Oh, yes, yes.
Although you couldn't see anything or hear anything.
Yes.
You sensed it.
Yes. Your senses, after a period of time in action, you see, you went right back to nature. All your senses. In fact, the one patrol I was on, I said, right, into that particular house, you stay there, I'm going to have a look round. See? So I had about 5 men with us, and I put them in this room in this house. And I went, it was a big farmhouse, I said, I went raking around, you know, to see if there was anything there. And coming back, I said, why, remember, I said, I could smell tobacco smoke. And I went in, and I said, have you been smoking? Nobody admitted. I said, I know you're blowing well half, because I said, I can smell it a mile away. So I gave them a rocket in for smoking. But that's just one of your senses coming in. You could get, as I said, when I worked at the mine, I knew there was someone beside me, you know. And you find that in action, you know, you say, there's somebody there, you know. And you stop and you start and think and you look to make sure that, you know, everything's all right. But you do actually go, back to nature. There was one other thing near Ortona. There was a big railway tunnel. Now, what the Germans normally used to do was blow the tunnels up. I've told you before how he had this hook on the back of the end and he used to pull all the tracks up. Well, he used to blow the tunnels up. No, because he knew we were repairing the railways and using them. But the action must have been so quick. It would not the action that I did, I was in, but the attraction, I think it was the Indian Army that attacked this place first. And the first thing they did, the sappers came forward and went in this tunnel and mined it to stop the Germans going in, blowing it up. And when I finally took over, I had to take a patrol out one night with these engineers, and they had what they were going to do was disarm all the mines and take them all up, because they started, you know, getting the railway and that through the tunnel.